I'm Bruce Anderson of the Sunday Express. One of the glories of the American political system is the ease with which distinguished outsiders can become distinguished insiders at a turn of the electoral wheel. Thus it was with Henry Kissinger. For years he had studied and taught diplomacy at Harvard. His mind had marched with the great European masters, with Talleyrand, Metternich, and Bismarck. Then Richard Nixon gave him a chance to emulate them in 1968, and he took it in the most distinguished way. It was a remarkably creative period in American foreign policy. The achievements are manifold. First, the end of the Vietnam War. That could never have been a glorious episode. The opportunities for glory had disappeared some years previously. But it could have gone disastrously and humiliatingly wrong. And the reason it didn't was because of Dr. Kissinger's superb diplomatic efforts, reinforced by those of his president. Then there was détente. Now, because of later events in the Soviet Union, the importance of détente may now be obscured, but it was crucially important. Also, some critics, even on the right of American politics, have claimed that Dr. Kissinger made and President Nixon made too many concessions in the negotiation of détente. I think they're confusing the original détente concept with the weakness which Congress imposed on the Ford presidency and the weakness which the Carter presidency embraced for itself. But most important of all, there was the opening to China, to the end of a 20-year diplomatic isolation, and the beginning of events which it is impossible to foresee. The entry of China into world affairs is the most important thing that's happened in the last few years and could very well dominate world affairs in the course of the next century. When the history of that transformation comes to be written, the importance of the contribution President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger made cannot be overestimated. Now, Dr. Kissinger, I suppose it would be fair to say, has at times been a controversial figure. There's one fundamental reason for this. His American fellow countrymen, have always been ambivalent about the process of diplomacy and foreign policy. They've always seen the danger that the pristine purity of the Great Republic will somehow be compromised by these corrupt practices, which will involve it not only with alliances with the old world, the decadent old world, but which will endanger it in being sucked into war. Fortunately for the stability of the 20th century, fortunately for our prospects in Europe, those doubters have generally been overridden. Since America became a world power, two Secretary of State stand out, General Marshall and Dr. Henry Kissinger. It is an exalted preeminence. We in the Sunday Express regard it as a great privilege to have serialized and extracted Dr. Kissinger's book on diplomacy. For Dr. Kissinger is not only a statesman. His books, since he left office, in fact before as well, but particularly I think his memoirs on diplomacy, stand high in literature as well as in scholarship. We are proud to have made his words available to a wider audience. We hope that you will not just content yourself with our extracts, but read the book itself. And we are privileged and honored to hear Dr. Kissinger himself tonight.
Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, sometimes when I'm introduced in America, the chairman says that few people need an introduction less than I do. But he does not add that even fewer people enjoy an introduction more than I do, especially if it contains so many superlatives. Of course, the introduction leaves me in the position in which I once found myself at a cocktail party in America, where a lady came up to me and said, "I understand you're a fascinating man," she said. "Fascinate me." It turned into one of the less successful conversations I have had. Now, I am in London to promote my book, something I've never done before. And so I find myself making speeches about what I've already written. But rather than cover 900 pages of my book, let me just give you, let discuss with you somewhat what the problem is so far as American foreign policy is concerned that preoccupies me most. And then, after some reasonable period, I will stop and take some of your questions, keeping in mind that I'm a believer in the De Gaulle method of press conferences. De Gaulle held the view that he would not let a journalist tell him what he should talk about. Rather, he arrived at his press conferences with 5 prepared answers. And no matter what the question was, he would get it around to one of his answers. But let me talk about my concerns with respect to foreign policy in general, and especially the important role America must play. The United States is unique among the nations of the world, at least among the major nations of the world, in the sense that its history has a definite beginning. It can be dated precisely to a certain period. It didn't evolve as a nation. Secondly, it is peopled almost exclusively by immigrants, the vast majority of whom turned their back on Europe and who are therefore predisposed to believe that they represent values superior to those of Europe. Third, America has never had a powerful neighbor. The question of survival has never arisen for America. Fourth, the United States was protected from potential adversaries that were not neighbors by 2 vast oceans. As late as the middle of the Cold War, I made a speech in Omaha, Nebraska, and spoke about the perils of that period to a group of leading citizens of that town. And in the question period, somebody got up and said, "Now you say this country is in danger. But what could anyone want from us in Omaha?" Now the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command was 5 miles down the road. And the one city that was guaranteed to be attacked even before Washington was Omaha. But that had not yet sunk in to the consciousness of the Midwest. So all of this has produced a very particular American approach to the conduct of foreign policy. A belief that foreign policy, that the characteristics of a nation should be the same as the characteristics of an individual. They believe that nations fight not about interests, but about legal norms. They believe that you cannot differentiate on the basis of national interest, but that you must find some overarching general principles. In the 19th century, Britain and the United States had analogous formal policies. Britain called its policies splendid isolation. America left out the splendid. It was just isolated. But Britain's policy was strategic. America's was based on a claim of superior morality. Britain believed that its principal policy vis-à-vis Europe had to be to prevent Europe from coalescing into a unit that might threaten Britain. America believed that it wanted nothing to do with the rest of the world so long as they stayed out of the Western Hemisphere. Britain made few moral judgments. Fundamentally, it supported the weaker against the stronger. And for the rest, it tried to stay on good terms with as many nations as possible, so that when a decision had to be made, it could throw its weight in either direction. America had no strategy. And when it emerged in 1917 into world affairs, or into European affairs, it approached the problem from a totally different perspective from the Europeans. It declared the cause of the war to be the German emperor, an individual. And while the German emperor had governed for 29 years and was in fact thought a little hard, Churchill wrote about him, "If you are on top of a volcano, you might as well smoke." It hadn't occurred to anyone that he, as an individual, was the cause of the war. A normal European settlement would have attempted to be structural and to create situations in which German domination was impossible. America tried to bring about a situation in which, through the spread of democracy, aggression would no longer be conceived. So physical safeguards, the issue of physical safeguards, did not arise. And this theme that America represents interests, principles rather than interests, has been fundamental throughout. In World War II, when the Germans invaded Russia, Churchill said, "If the Germans invade hell, I will find something good to say about the devil," which left the moral stature of Stalin quite open. The American approach was to make Stalin an honorary American. He became Uncle Joe, the great moderate, the guarantor of peace. And Roosevelt thought of preserving the peace by a coalition of Russia, China, Britain, and the United States. In other words, making no allowance at all for possible differences in interests that might arise. In fact, we had an emissary who came to Moscow with a movie that was made during the war, which took Stalin's side of the purges and declared the victims guilty. And our emissary showed this to the Politburo at the American Embassy. And our embassy reported afterwards, our Soviet guests watched the movie in stunned amazement, as indeed they might. As it turned out, the Cold War was ideally made for American perception. There was an ideological adversary. There was an overwhelming strategic adversary, and they were the same. The world could be divided into two camps, with the good guys being on one side and the evil ones on the other. And the war could be conducted, the Cold War could be conducted, with a vast mobilization of resources. Moreover, there is about American policy an idealistic streak which is responsible for many of the best things that have happened in this century. I cannot think of another country that would have conceived rebuilding Europe and Japan after a devastating war, and indeed the world entirely with its own resources. After Truman left office, I called on him once in Independence, Missouri, and I asked him of what he was most proud in his presidency. And he said, what I'm most proud of is that we defeated our enemies completely and that we then brought them back as equals to the community of nations. That's a very American answer, and a beautiful answer in many respects. So I am not criticizing the past American performance. It won the Cold War. It produced the present world. And it produced it with a theory, the containment theory, which again reflected its fundamental convictions, namely that the world is normally peaceful. If there is trouble, it is due to evil men who must be destroyed or converted. The containment theory was an amazing concept in that it said, if we contain the Soviets long enough, they will change internally. What we would do then was never discussed. It was thought to be automatic that a changed Russia would be like any other society. I have an acquaintance in America, if you ladies and gentlemen will forgive me, who holds the view that there is no such thing as a British accent. He thinks the British put this on to intimidate Americans. And if you can only wake up an Englishman unawares, like at 4 in the morning, he will speak like a normal human being. This was sort of the attitude towards Russia during the containment period. But now we've won the Cold War. The magic day has arrived. And we find ourselves in the dilemma described by George Bernard Shaw. which is, there are two tragedies in life. One is to fail to fulfill your heart's desire, and the second is to fulfill your heart's desire. What does America do now? How is one to understand the world in which we live today, after the Cold War is over? That is a huge philosophical problem for Americans. There is no tradition in America of thinking in terms of equilibrium. And yet, any study of history shows that if you have a group of nations of more or less equal strength, and if they are not grouped by some ideological principles, there are only two roads to stability: hegemony or balance of power. That is a concept very difficult for Americans to come to terms with. It would be difficult enough for my generation. It is even harder for the generation whose formative experience was in the Vietnam War. My generation of Americans was associated with experiences of which they could be proud, and with creative periods of American foreign policy. The present generation of leaders has been associated, many of them, with a protest movement which systematically attacked what America stood for, and which represents a point of view according to which America must clean itself before it can be active internationally. People say, and it is true, that Clinton wants to be a domestic and not a foreign policy president. And some of the reason for that is political, because there was some feeling that Bush was too active internationally at the expense of domestic concerns. But some of it is also that he comes from the movement that thought America had no moral right to act internationally, and that therefore he believes that only an America that carries out the domestic reforms for which he stands, or tries to stand, can play an active role. Then I believe there are two other elements. In almost every country that I know, and certainly in almost every democratic country that I know, the quality of leadership declines from decade to decade. And the reason is almost built in. I used to hear Harold Macmillan talk about what it was like to be at Oxford before World War I. Now I admit some of this was at fundraisers for Oxford, so he was not beyond laying it on a little heavily. But it is interesting that some of the tremendous personalities of the post-World War II period all had their formative experiences before World War I. And with every decade, in terms of educational system, family values and consciousness, the sense of security has diminished And this is particularly true in modern politics when the balance sheet is struck every evening by the evening news. Now, almost every foreign policy of any consequence that I know anything about takes a long period to mature. One of Nixon's strengths, to which the chairman so kindly referred, was that while he cared a lot, no matter what he said, about public opinion, he did not act on his reaction to it. It infuriated him, but he stuck his course. Today, when I entered political life, political figures would ask me what to think. Current political figures ask me what to say. It's an important difference, and it makes for tremendous insecurity. It is said that the Clinton administration acts only in crisis. There's some merit in that. But part of the reason is that they don't know they have a problem until there is a crisis. And I believe this is true of much of political life today in many countries. And finally, I believe that the advent of television and the computer produces a new human consciousness comparable to the invention of printing at the end of the Middle Ages. Before printing, knowledge was sort of liturgical and repetitive. Printing permitted to spread it more widely and to stress memory less. Television shifts consciousness from concepts to pictures, and from the relationship of events to the experience of the moment. In watching television, you may be deeply impressed, but you cannot repeat the experience. And after a while, it is difficult to remember exactly what it was that impressed you, or whether it would still impress you if you saw it 3 months later. With books, you need concepts. With pictures, you form impressions. And I fear this produces a much more emotional, short-term, tactical kind of foreign policy. And I don't say this about America. I believe this is true in almost all societies where you have this confluence of politics and visual presentation. Nor do I say it critically. I see in myself, I cannot learn from pictures. I go to meetings and they're briefing the devil out of me with charts. And I understand them perfectly when I see them. My problem is I don't remember them. With my children, the opposite obtains. I've written 10 books, which, whatever their quality, is hard work. But I think I impress the next generation more by doing a 5-minute stint on a morning show than by writing a long book. Now, all I'm describing is the context within which America now has to make its decisions. And those are huge decisions. We have to come to some understanding of our relationship with Europe. When you think about it, we have done nothing about it in this administration. The president came to Europe in January, but what did he have? A plan for dealing with Russia. And what was the plan? Some sort of multilateral relationship that whose virtue was its multilateralism, not its purpose. What we are facing is that this big area from Vladivostok to the center of Europe is now in flux. And how to fill it? And how to keep an imperial Russia from reappearing is a problem as old as the 17th century. Now, some people say it can be changed by domestic reform in Moscow. I see no sign of it. And in any event, we don't know how to do that. How to conceive this? I am a strong opponent of this partnership for peace because I would like some structure as a safety net which defines a limit in Europe. I'm all for Russian participation in economic and other enterprises. But I'm not going to be able to go into detail on all these issues. I simply want to point out that by looking at these problems as purely abstract theoretical ones, one forgets that Europe had a previous experience when it established two categories of borders. At Locarno in 1925, and this turned into a debacle. And the countries of Eastern Europe, Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, should not be caught again between Germany and Russia. And a Germany, which in the absence of an American anchor, may well go back to some national policy. We have a tendency to see communities where none exists. Last year, there was a lot of discussion about an Asian community at a conference in Seattle. There is no Asian community. The relation of China to Japan and Russia is the relation of Russia to Japan and China. The relation of all of them to India and Southeast Asia is most comparable to the relation of European states in the 19th century to each other. And the American role, painful as it is for us, in Asia, should be very similar to Britain's role towards Europe. In Europe, we can deal with a community of states, however they organize themselves. In Asia, we have to maintain some sort of equilibrium, which is one reason I was so much in favor of better relations with China. So America is going now through an enormous intellectual and emotional crisis, and would do so no matter which party is in office, incidentally. I'm not a supporter of the present administration, but fairness requires pointing out that the problems I have described are not created by them. In 1945, Truman faced a comparable problem when the world envisioned by Roosevelt collapsed. It took him 3 years to solve it, and it was an easier problem in terms of historic American preconception. This is what we're up against. This is what I tried to deal with in my book by showing how various international systems have operated and what the role of values and balance of power was and how America has participated in it. But whatever the merit of the book, this is the problem we face. And when all the concerns about America are said and done, I know that there's no foreign country that understands better than this one how essential America remains to the peace, the progress, and prosperity of the world. So what I'm describing is not a national problem, but an international one, and one which I believe we will, in the end, overcome. And now let me take some of your questions. Thank you very much. I asked the chairman whether he could identify the troublemakers, and he said he couldn't, so I said, I'll take the questions. We'll alternate them between downstairs and the balcony. Let's start down here. My period fell at the cusp of that period. I do not believe that I ever watched the evening news. Or if I did, it was a very rare event. And if I did, it was only to find out in what order they covered events. But I frankly have no recollection that I ever watched it. I did not want to be told. There were press summaries circulating. I paid very little attention to them. So in my day, I mean, on the other hand, President Nixon, as you can see in the Haldeman diaries and other things, was very, very concerned with them. But he was concerned with them sort of as to confirm the hostility of the outside world without conducting his policy in order to produce a media event. I never met with a focus group in my life. I don't even know how it operates. You know, these groups by which the politicians now determine, at least in America, what is supposed to be on people's minds. In any event, I believe they're totally unreliable with respect to foreign policy. Because I do not believe the public forgives their leaders for failures, even if those failures reflect the wishes of the public. Because they expect the leaders to know better. Then gradually, the real master of the media was Reagan. I mean, it gradually developed, but even Ford was a traditional politician. Of course, he lost the election, too. I believe now television is dominant. Events are staged, are carefully analyzed in terms of the impact they produce visually. The United States, what was going on in Sarajevo was intellectually known for at least a year and a half. but it took the shelling of a marketplace where it is not even fully clear who did it. On a Saturday morning, so it was covered all weekend on CNN, to galvanize an action that could have been taken at any point, and for which I'm sure there were many written reports available. It was pictures of starvation in Somalia, which could have been duplicated in Mozambique, certainly in the Sudan, which receives no coverage at all, that triggered America into sending troops into Somalia, where we had no discernible national interest. And then the killing of 18 Americans generated a rapid exit. And then you have this endless parade of talk shows, and I believe now we have arrived at a really full-scale media-dominated policy. There's somebody up there. Yes, sir. Where? No, I mean, where, in what part of the world? Well, first of all, people sometimes write about me as if I were burning votive candles to Metternich on his birthday or death day. Metternich lived in a totally different environment. He was an aristocrat governing a German-dominated state, though he spoke French and wrote in French. I mean, he was a cosmopolitan. He was a creature of the 18th century who believed in the great clockwork. I mean, who was closer to the Voltaire type of thinking than to the democratic thinking of the 19th century. I dealt with him at length because his state was domestically so rigid and potentially so weak, and because he used foreign policy with extraordinary skill to make the rest of the world comport with what his state could stand. And so he would send out instructions in which he would say, it is more important for us to prevent the excessive claims of others than put forward our own. And he was important in my thinking because he understood better than many of his successors that you need equilibrium, but you also need shared values to moderate the assertions of power in the balance of power. Now, the common values he advocated are outdated today, but the concept was valid because once the values had been disintegrated, and all that was left was power, it led to the race of the armaments race prior to World War I, and these two rigid alliances that had no diplomatic leeway anymore, something that Metternich would have striven to his utmost to avoid. Now, in our day, the basic concept of creating enough of a sense of community to maintain a non-catastrophic equilibrium still exists. The problem is how to analyze the equilibrium and what values can serve that purpose, especially given the American propensity to think they must be American values imposed by pressure on other countries, which has the opposite effect of what we seek. So it's not an answer of what he would do, but it explains what I've been trying to deal with. Yes, sir. Well, first of all, I believe that the American analysis is correct. The development of nuclear weapons in North Korea can only have extremely unfortunate consequences. If a very poor country can bootstrap itself into major international attention by developing a nuclear capability, then there's no reason in the world why others shouldn't do it. And it's very difficult to deal with, because when you offer them a way out by economic assistance, which so far they haven't taken, you're really creating more incentives to build nuclear capabilities so that they get so that they can see what price they can sell it, assuming they're going to sell it, which I don't believe they will do. Now, I believe the American policy has vacillated too much and has not exhibited a real determination, because of a belief which you can see in almost all negotiations since World War II, that America has to fuel the negotiation by making concessions at the beginning. Now, I would state as a general principle of foreign policy that you never get paid for services already rendered. And so canceling military, joint military operations, not sending certain categories of weapons, offering to negotiate directly with the North Koreans, all of this gives them the sense that we are very uncertain. On the other hand, what can we do? Analytically, the North Korean capability threatens China far more than the United States. Secondly, it threatens Japan, and it will surely accelerate what I believe is happening anyway, the nuclearization of Japan, which in turn threatens China. So therefore, I have an ambivalent position. On the one hand, I'm in favor of a strong policy. On the other, I don't want to get ahead of China, and to a lesser extent, Japan. I do not see how we, Americans, can enforce an economic blockade of North Korea. I would strongly favor it. But I would tell the Chinese that if they can live with a nuclear Korea at their border, we can, with great reluctance, do too. And we are not going to be conducting sanctions from which the neighbors of Korea benefit. So I would strongly favor an economic blockade. I would not favor a military operation against North Korea unless China and Japan participate, but I would apply that also to the blockade. But I believe a blockade would do it. Yes, sir. In the Middle East? I don't know. I I believe it's my personal opinion, and it's that it's a purely tactical move by people who think the fundamentalists will probably win in Algeria. My general view, to state another maxim, is that one ought to make concessions when one has maneuvering room, because if one makes them later, they look extracted and they therefore encourage pressure. I don't think it will do much good, to tell you the truth. Now, whether a broader gauged approach to fundamentalism could work, that would probably have to start in Iran rather than in Algeria. I don't know. Is there what? I believe there's a fundamentalist tendency, partly because a certain fundamentalism is inherent in Islam to begin with. Not saying it's always at the top, but the fundamentalists respond to something real. I don't know whether there is a conspiracy that has a headquarters and that gives instructions. But I believe there is an anti-Western, anti-materialistic attitude, an effort to make good centuries of humiliation, which will be very difficult to conciliate. Yes, sir. Can you, how much were Nixon and I?
Influenced by the Council of Foreign Relations study group on the Vietnam settlement?
Not at all. I didn't even know there was a council. even now I don't know what you're referring to. Before I went into government, I often went to the Council on Foreign Relations. And I wrote an article for Foreign Affairs, which was in fact published after I was appointed, which sort of laid out the strategy which we then followed, namely to settle the military issues of the war between ourselves and the North Vietnamese, and leave the political evolution to the Vietnamese. That was our basic strategy. Might have been vaguely influenced by my visits to the Council of Foreign Relations, but I honestly do not know, I'm not being flippant, that there was a study group on war aims at the Council on Foreign Relations. And certainly, after we came into office, the majority of the membership of the council was so hostile to Nixon that I didn't even go there ever to speak. Well, the question is, with the development of a United States of Europe, to what extent is national sovereignty threatened? Well, obviously, if the lower version of Europe, the federal Maastricht Europe, emerges, national sovereignty will be impaired. That is its essence. And that is, as I understand it, the political issue in this country. If a confederal Europe emerges, I think it will be less threatened. Now, whether one doesn't have to make national sovereignty the ultimate goal of history. My impression is that with the entry into Europe of so many new states, with the disappearance of the fathers of Maastricht, the last important of whom is Kohl, that something other than the Maastricht Europe is going to emerge, and that therefore the national sovereignty issue will become less acute. Yes, sir.
I wanted to address one thing which is pervaded throughout your talk and throughout your book, and that is the emphasis in US foreign policy on principle as opposed to pragmatism. And I think it's something which is quite important. Now, you talk specifically about values, and you're comparing that really to the lack of values and the ad hoc response of the current administration to crises such as Bosnia and in Somalia. Now, my question to you is, what kinds of values do you see the U.S. should be adopting in promoting foreign policy throughout the world and towards possibly helping the achievement of world peace?
I believe that the United States has to learn a concept of the national interest to help guide it through these crises. If we had analyzed it systematically, we would never have put troops into Somalia, because putting troops into Somalia left us either with the choice of staying there indefinitely, which the American public would not have stood for, or engaging in a civil war to rectify the political conditions that produced the starvation, which was bound to produce casualties that the American people also wouldn't stand for. Therefore, we should never have gone in there with forces. I'm all in favor of giving humanitarian aid to Somalia. Bosnia, my personal view on Bosnia is that Bosnia is not a nation, and that it should never have been made a nation, because it is composed of Serbs, Muslims, and Croats, who are united only in the determination not to live under each other. And the only reason the Croats and the Muslims have gotten together is so that they can fight the Serbians, not because they have any real common interest. So it would have been better to establish a UN trusteeship, a European trusteeship, anything, or partition the country, which would have left many more territories under Muslim rule than will be the case now. Once the war started, I believe there were two separate problems. One, should outside powers engage themselves in forcing a restoration of the status quo ante? Second, could the outside world enforce an end to the human suffering? I believe the first objective was beyond the willingness of sacrifice of the outside world. That is to say, one could force a restoration of the status quo ante only by a military occupation and military operations of a length that would have been insupportable. The second one was achievable, but it had the paradox that it would have confirmed the status quo and therefore some conquest. And in order to avoid confirming the conquest, the humanitarian road was not taken, with the result that since then there have been double the amount of conquests, and we are still faced with the same problem. So that, in brief, is my view on Bosnia. I can support what was done in Sarajevo and in Gorazde. I could not support a ground operation to restore the boundaries of Bosnia, even though I believe great horrors have been committed there.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Is what?
It's awful, which is basically what news is. So it naturally follows a demand for laws. My question is, do you think an authoritarian dictatorship is inevitable?
I don't believe an authoritarian you mean all over the world? No, I believe this. That if violence continues to be such an important part of everyday life and conflicts become more and more unrestrained, that the democratic demand for strong government will produce some demagogic leaders. I would regret that deeply. And it would be a failure of the democratic systems. And having lived as a young boy in a totalitarian state, I don't think one can imagine the combination of inefficiency and brutality that this sort of rule produces. But I also don't believe that I do believe that if violence in our societies is not curbed, that the public will take an increasingly strong stand. I can tell you from a personal experience on the Singapore flogging, in which all our newspapers were against the flogging. I would go to give speeches and never get close to mentioning Singapore. And people in receptions would come up to me afterwards and said, "Don't you join the people who try to stop the flogging." I think the American public was 70% in favor of what Singapore did. I'm not defending it. I'm simply describing the mood that may be emerging. This lady in the rear. Well, first of all, there are much fewer jobs available here politically. I mean, in America, when an administration changes, everybody who has a presidential appointment, which is through deputy assistant secretary, is automatically fired. So that thousands of jobs become available every 4 to 8 years. Here the civil service continues. I was present here when the Heath government changed to the Wilson government. And while our sympathies, if we had, were basically more on the Tory side, Heath gave us a terrible time, it gave us Americans a terrible time, and the Foreign Office loyally and efficiently put the needle in on every occasion. I came here, as it happened, about 3 days after the change of government in Callahan was foreign secretary. And they started the usual stuff of Europe and America. And it was exactly the same group. And Callahan said, "This will stop now." And they turned on a dime. And this would be absolutely unthinkable in America. I mean, we don't have such a disciplined civil service, we have to replace the people. But it also means that every 4 years they uproot the trees to see whether the roots are still there. And they start a study of the elements of American foreign policy. Every once in a while, it leads to a refreshing input. But I think given our system and given the fact, I mean, this is a capital city. Washington is a seat of government. It's a big difference. So when people come to Washington, they don't represent any particular unified view. Most presidents have not met their cabinet members until they appoint them. I had never met Nixon when I was appointed security advisor. You know, I read these books about my plotting to get into that job, which I tell you how I did it. I supported Nixon's principal opponent in 3 straight elections. And I'm not conscious of ever having said a good word about Nixon until he appointed me. The American system has its problems. Now, that relationship between Nixon and me on a working level was very successful, but you also run huge risks, and it becomes very difficult to form a team. While the British leaders have worked together for decades before they become get into high office. Yes, sir.
I thought I'd try the mic. I don't know if it works. Both you and Solzhenitsyn have spoken, I put you together quite gloomily about the state of Russia, and I have heard you just now say this. Can you go into greater detail what your personal opinions are and what you think the United States policy ought to be?
When I was in government, I used to say to my colleagues, we are not a foundation, we are a government. We are not missionaries, we represent a national interest. I still say that. I do not see how the United States can manipulate the domestic politics of Russia. And they have become progressively harsher the more we have tried to intervene. Last year there was a period of a few months where almost every day some leading U.S. official would say, we support Yeltsin. Addressed to whom? What does this mean? I have nothing against Yeltsin. And I don't know a better leader. But it's not my job to produce a leader in Russia. So the belief that you can make Russia a democratic country, and the second belief that a democratic Russia will solve our foreign policy problem is, I believe, fallacious. We can get along with Russia excellently if Russia stays within its borders. And since these borders encompass 11 time zones, that should not produce claustrophobia. But that means in practice that we must discourage pressures against the former members of the Soviet Union, all of which are under some form of Russian attack now, all of which have Russian troops on their borders, and to none of which the West has responded. Russia is refusing to demarcate the border with Ukraine. it is challenging the border with Estonia. It intervenes in almost every civil war around its borders. Now, I believe we should attempt to put some limits to the re-imperialization of this space. Because if Russian troops appear again at the borders of Poland and Hungary, we will have a Europe that is again overhung by Russia. And we will then have that appendage of Poland hanging there, not guaranteed by the West, and a Germany which will blame us for the mess that has occurred, all of which will create nationalism. I favor Russian participation in the G7. I think Russia should be able to participate fully in the European Security Conference. Some degree of economic aid to Russia is also appropriate. But it should not be much larger than economic aid given to the rest of the former Soviet Union. But simultaneously, we should concentrate at least to attach importance to countries like Ukraine, with a population of 58 million, which is in the process of being dissolved without any significant Western assistance, and which admittedly has a rotten government, but it has also been totally neglected for 4 years. Yes, sir.
Being someone who spent a great deal of time constructively in the Middle East, how optimistic are you about the events of the last few months or so in these processes?
From a technical point of view, I mean, if you just analyze the agreement, I think the Israeli PLO agreement has huge flaws, and you can point out 100 things that can go wrong with it. On the other hand, if you look at the status quo before the agreement, there were maybe 150 things that could go wrong with it. So I sympathize with those who've made the agreement. And while there are some aspects of it that trouble me, I believe it is it's an attempt that must be made. I do not think it will lead to peace with a capital P, in the sense that a moment will be reached where, after which, all tensions will fall away. But I don't think that's the issue. The issue is whether coexistence can be achieved, in which the Israelis gain security and the Arabs gain dignity. Now, that is going to be very difficult and can only be worked out in day-to-day experience. I think that Israel has to face the fact that what they have done must lead to a Palestinian state. They cannot avoid it. The Palestinians must face the fact that a Palestinian state requires that Israel be given certain strategic territories, since the 67 borders are untenable. That is a really key issue, and it mustn't get dissolved in discussing how to do joint patrols and all the other paraphernalia of this agreement. But within, not even these limits, with this amplification, I think it is the only road that could be taken. Yes, ma'am.
You said you were quite happy about the conciliatory approach.
The what?
China. The conciliatory approach of America towards China.
Yes.
Doesn't uphold that value in China, then how is America, is America not going to be in trouble in other countries such as Iran, for instance?
Such as where?
Iran, where it wants to fight fundamentally.
No. I think we're in trouble in Iran, as it is. And I don't think the Iranian attitudes are even remotely affected by what we do about human rights in China. And even less do I think that the attitudes of the opponents of the present regime in Iran are affected by it. Nor do I believe that what has been done has been at the sacrifice of human rights. I, on the contrary, believe that a confrontation between China and Russia and the United States would provide precisely the excuse for the hardliners to go back to an austerity policy in economics and therefore to a crackdown in politics. And I'm of the view that we will make more human rights progress, one, by the economic evolution of China, and secondly, by closer relations. But I tell you frankly, I do not believe that human rights can be the only objective of American foreign policy. It has to be related to strategic, political, and economic objectives. And it is in that sense that I support what Clinton has done. I'm willing to keep this thing going, but my question is, I have to leave here about 8:20.
8:20? You represent 8:20?
How long did I agree to stay? No, I mean, I have to sign some books, don't I? Well, who are the organizers here? How long should I let this?
What?
Well, if you want the book signed, and since I don't want people to be disappointed, we have to bring it. What do you think? Okay, I'll take this gentleman on the far. Yes, sir. You get up, somebody else will jump you. And then I'll take one more. Look, the foreign policy of a great power cannot be conducted as if it were a bull session in a common room of some university. I was in office, for example, during part of Somoza's regime. We neither supported him nor didn't support him. I was happy for every day I didn't have to think about Nicaragua because I had 500 other problems to deal with. And there are only so many things you can deal with realistically. And if you go around overturning governments, then you get into a Sandinista type and Contra type and problem afterwards. So you have to decide where your priorities are. Now, if we were involved with Vietnam I'm talking now about the presidential level, China, and you didn't aim this particularly at the administration in which I served. Soviet Union, Europe, all in processes of change. And most of the instances you mentioned were instances of neglect rather than instances of really very active support. I really do not believe that the United States can go on crusades around the world to overturn every government we do not like. It is beyond our capacities, and it will wind up in a wild isolationism. That doesn't mean mistakes don't get made, and that one should not, that some of the instances you mentioned could not have been handled better. Now, when you talk about Machiavelli, Machiavelli wrote two books, The Prince, in which he said this is the way 15th century Italy works. He didn't say he liked it. Nobody has yet said he was wrong. It is a reasonably accurate account. He wrote another book, The Discourses, of how he would like Italy to evolve. Nobody ever mentions that. That was his moral, the moral side. So, of course, you have to make practical decisions. And to some extent, they're Machiavellian. But I do not think one can understand American foreign policy unless one understands that the major thrust of it, maybe hypocritically, is focused on principle. Now I'll take an absolutely final question because I have to go. Why don't you recognize the last question?
Well, the gentleman there.
I'd like to ask you, you mentioned, I think quite compellingly a moment ago, that in times past people would ask you what to think. Today people ask you what to say. To sort of close on that, I'd like you to give us a few words on what you think we should be keeping in mind Cold War era.
Now that requires a long answer. I've already given one, Russia. Second, the evolving pattern in Asia. Because I believe Japan will become nuclear. I believe that China will become strong enough to become potentially dominant. I believe India will become very strong. And the interplay of those nations, together with Southeast Asia, plus a potentially unified Korea, plus Russia, could be very, very, very complicated. Then I believe, there I'm a minority, that we will probably find that absolute free trade isn't going to work, because somebody wins, and somebody loses. That's why you want free trade. And if the loser has a political process, he will try to guard himself against the consequences, which is called protectionism. And this could easily develop in the 21st century. I'm just telling you problems. I'm not offering solutions. Thank you very much.
Dr. Kissinger said that he was often told he needed no introduction. He certainly needs no conclusion. There's only one way to follow up a tour d'horizon like that, and that is to read his book, copies of which are now available for signing.